Blog Talk Radio. Good morning, folks. This is Crystal and Beek Larson coming to you live from Cosmic Citizen this morning in lovely downtown Boulder, Colorado. And with me is my co-host, Andre Rodatis. Good morning, Andre. Hello?
Good morning, Crystal. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Sorry about the length of that bumper music, but it was really beautiful. It's a piece by a woman by the name of Mary Ellen, and I'm very sorry I don't know her last name. But I know that this is going to be one of the pieces played at the Yosemite Summer Jesus Birthday Celebration at the Grizzly Giant. So that's all I know about that piece at the moment. Anyway, the topic for our show today is our seraphic planetary government and the Master Seraphim. Paula is on break this weekend. She's out of town on business. So Andre and I are going to be running the program. And with us, we have our guest, Neil Waldrop. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning, Crystalline. Are you still struggling with snow in your part of Colorado?
Well, we have had quite a bit of snow in the last 2 weeks, but today it's 70 degrees, and my husband just went out for a walk in shorts, so there might still be some snow on the ground, but it's really warming up.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. How about Quebec, Andre?
Well, Quebec is cool today. It has been warming up steadily, but today we've got kind of a cool, overcast day. But I've personally witnessed just 2 days ago a brief 15-minute snow squall that came up that really made you think you were in December once again. It's kind of funny up here.
We've had a relatively pleasant spring in the area of Washington, D.C. It was warm for a while. It's chilled out a little bit. It's now somewhere in the high 50s and low 60s during the day, which is pleasant. For my part, I would be happy if that weather would continue for the next 3 months instead of getting miserably hot and muggy the way it usually does in the Washington.
Yeah, that's typical. Now, are you now in cherry blossom time, or...?
Yes, which is to say that the blossoms are blossoming in the downtown area on the tidal basin next to the monument area. Typically, they attract a large number of people, and so if you're going to go there to take pictures and see the cherry blossoms, mostly what you'll see is other people.
Uh-huh. Doing the same.
The experience that I had in the previous year was to pick a day that was relatively chilly but sunny and a little bit windy, so there weren't many people, and I did get a decent selection of photos showing the vista of water and the cherry trees. But obviously it's a tourist attraction of great beauty and gift by the government of Japan between World War I and World War II, at a time when Japan and the United States were friendly, which is, of course, the case now. But we had a slight disagreement in the middle.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. I need to interrupt and just say I do need to acknowledge the amazing musician that played our bumper this morning. Her name is Marianne Brundage. So I apologize for getting that wrong earlier. But anyway, thanks for plugging that for us, Andre.
Absolutely, yeah. It was lovely. I probably should have paid attention to the length of it.
Well,
anyway.
Back to the topic.
Yes.
Speaking of the cherry blossoms and the relationship between the government of the U.S. and Japan, that actually is kind of an interesting segue to break into our topic today, because we have on our world sort of vacillated back and forth from states of real conflict and then great strides in peacemaking. And the relationship with the Japanese and the American governments is one of those that has been rather dramatic in the shift.
Yes, it has.
I think that the extreme paradox in my lifetime, which is a lifetime that started shortly after World War II, is that in the early 1980s, Japan was viewed as a compelling economic competitor and destined to dominate the world economically. Well, people who predict matters by a straight line going out from the trend of the last few years always get it wrong, because just a few years later, Japan went into an economic crisis from which it has not really recovered. It's still stagnant. And now people are looking at the economy of China and declaring that China will dominate the world because they are taking this straight line and projecting it. By and large, I think the seraphic planetary government has a better view of different cycles in the history of human beings and different progressions. We've been through perhaps three centuries of unusually high levels of invention in science and technology, but the rest of human life has been changing much less rapidly. And one of the issues that I think the seraphic planetary government has to deal with is that human beings need to catch up in the ways that we love each other and the ways that we treat each other with kindness and fairness as compared with the advances that science and technology have made in the last several centuries.
Indeed.
So you're saying essentially that philosophically and even more so spiritually, or even less so if we want to say it that way, they have not kept a pace with the kinds of scientific and material advancement that we've been able to make on the planet in the last century or two.
When you say they, you probably are talking about human beings. I think the seraphim
right.
are doing the best they can. But the underlying difficulty is that the ways that human beings behave to each other really have not seen a major upgrade in the last 500 years. If we see a story about the Borgia family, which at one point was the family name of the Pope in Rome, and who is the subject of a series by HBO, as perhaps both of you already know, we can identify with these characters because they're behaving in ways that are not commendable for sure, but they're behaving in ways that are not too different from the way that people behave now. By comparison, they could not possibly program a VCR. They did not have any access to electronic mail or computers. And so the advances in technology have gone much faster than the advances in human behavior. Sometimes I say that, in effect, the advances in technology and science and mathematics have been through a geometric progression, ever accelerating through the last several centuries, whereas the changes in human behavior, the ways that we treat each other, have continued to improve, but very slowly, on what would be called an arithmetic progression in mathematical terms. The curve keeps going up, but it goes very slowly. Whereas the context of science and technology has intensified the dilemma for human beings in that, the typical reaction of humanity to an advance in science is to turn it into a military weapon to kill other people. And I imagine that the seraphim are very worried about that, because we have to get to a point where we're not using new inventions destructively.
That does seem to have been a pattern, you know, a repeated pattern. And it seems to me also that one of the really crucial factors in this type of progression is our ability to communicate effectively with each other and our capacity to cope with what I would say call emotional resilience, or, you know, our ability to be more mature in how we cope with our unpleasant emotions. Those are things that we haven't really had a lot of education or practice, or, you know, certainly not very many people seem to specialize in those skills and transfer them or teach them to others. Seems like that might be an area that's pretty important to our seraphic guides.
Well, I agree with you in that. One of the dilemmas of organizational patterns pertains to ambition and a desire to obtain power. Now, on the one hand, in any endeavor, in any operation, one has to have ambitious people because they have drive. They have a desire to advance. But at the same time, one has to protect the others from predatory or domineering techniques by these people who are ambitious. And this is a very difficult matter, because the energies of ambitious people are an extremely important element. And they tend to supply an impetus that would otherwise be lacking. But the difficulty is that they also seek to gratify their own egos very often and exert authority because it pleases them, instead perhaps because they really envision a goal that benefits the group as a whole.
Indeed. What does your ranch book say about, you know, having power and refusing to use it?
Right.
You know, that's a fairly critical element in human maturation.
Whereas in looking at the governments of the world, most of them flunk that test, frankly.
Indeed.
Most government officials many government officials in most countries are using power for their own purposes. Another way of saying that is corruption is very serious. Mm-hmm. So we have not gotten to the point where the great majority of human beings can expect honest government. They do not have that expectation in most countries of the world. We could look through the trends of the last 40 years and say that the collapse of the former Soviet Union was a great achievement because it ended the domineering characteristics of an atheistic regime that was truly oppressive. And I totally agree with that statement. But by the same token, the people of Russia have now fallen into a different kind of tyranny, wherein the autocratic government of the current president, whose name I will not use at the moment, has sought to dominate all aspects of civil life instead of allowing people the freedom to associate and express their wishes, even if it is not necessarily congenial to particular officials of the government.
Well, so, and that collapse was a very rapid, unplanned, disorganized event, which caused, you know, pretty much the whole empire to disintegrate. And even though from some democratic or at least American viewpoints, many people thought this was a really great thing, in the short-sighted viewpoint, it really did it left a vacuum that was pretty dangerous for the world as a whole.
Yes, the common conclusion that analysts of international relations reach is that during the so-called Cold War, wherein the Soviet Union on one hand and its allies, the United States on the other hand and its allies, confronted each other in a strategic sense, the world as a whole was fairly stable because the dangers of a huge confrontation were so great. Now, after
right.
the Soviet Union collapsed, then a variety of small issues dividing particular groups in particular regions came front and center and became very difficult to deal with. For example, we had the terrible events in Rwanda where approximately 800,000 people were hacked to death with machetes. We had the civil war in the former Yugoslavia. And these are only two of the more notable examples of cases in which antagonisms had approximately been held in check by the previous climate of confrontation. But the world has to get beyond that. We have to find different ways of dealing with each other that are based on common interest and mutual understanding and an effort, as Crystalline said earlier, to deal with our various emotions in ways that are constructive and productive. And I would imagine that the Seraphim are, on the one hand, optimistic that this will eventually happen, but perhaps a bit fatigued in how slowly human beings learn these lessons.
Well, I would like to take us back to the beginning of paper 114. And before we do that, though, I'd like to just give you a brief opportunity to introduce yourself and your work, your current work now, Neil. We gave a little bit of a bio last week on the kind of work you've done with the government over the last few decades, but I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about the work you're doing now, and then I'd like to just have us start reading just the introduction to paper 114, The Seraphic Planetary Government.
Thank you very much, Crystalline. The question of how readers of the Urantia book can apply the teachings to help the world progress is one that I have been thinking about for most of the 40 years that I have been reading the teachings of the Urantia book. On the one hand, we are warned in paper 99 that religionists should confine their collective impulses to religious matters. On the other hand, there is a tremendous amount of material in part 3 which talks about the need to advance human society. So, in very general terms, it was hard to reconcile those two principles. In 1988, specifically in July of 1988, I attended a regional conference held in the Washington area and gave a speech. The speech, in effect, talked about the challenges of advancing human society, and I referred to perhaps 8 or 10 different passages in the Urantia book that posed the issue, including a very potent statement by Melchizedek that humanity is in front of about 1,000 years of ceaseless changes and adjustments, that we have to find ways to preserve civilization and advance the levels of human society. Well, in the short run, I didn't have an answer. I had a diagnosis of the problem, and over the next few years, I gave other speeches. Just a few months after that, I was transferred with my family from Washington to Geneva, Switzerland, where I worked for 4 years, and then returned in the summer of 2002. In that intervening time, the problem was still there, and I had moved it around in various combinations, but I had not reached a conclusion. In September of 2003, the trustees of Urantia Foundation invited me to begin participating actively in the work of the Board of Trustees in my capacity as a trustee emeritus, since I had served previously as a trustee, namely from 1992. A few months after I began working as a an active participant in the proceedings of the Board of Trustees, it finally occurred to me that the Master Seraphim, the 12 core of Master Seraphim, could be a spiritual model for an effort involving human beings. There are very strong psychological and intellectual and also emotional parallels. The Seraphim do not get directly involved in world events. On the other hand, they seek to stimulate human beings. And so this was a formula that I could work with intellectually because it would involve being in the background and helping others without seeking to dominate them. I made a proposal at that time to the trustees of Urantia Foundation for a committee to be established that would work on this concept. The trustees voted to do that in January of 2004, and they authorized me to recruit people who would be part of a committee to design the program. We worked on that basis for about 2.5 years in order to develop a plan, which is now called the Global Endeavor. This plan is a future goal. It is not a reality. It is an aspiration. It is very developed and very detailed. But at the moment, the Committee for the Global Endeavor is seeking to arouse interest in the perspective that it has to be an operation that has a wide base of support, not just readers in one country. And further, we have decided that it must include readers who speak French or Spanish, not just English. So I'm a little bit anticipating my story, because finally in January of 2007, the trustees of Urantia Foundation decided that this was an interesting project and meritorious, but it would not, in their judgment, be wise for Urantia Foundation to sponsor it, that it should be pursued independently. Well, at that time, I was quite disappointed. But finally, I came to understand that as an independent project, there were substantial advantages, because on that basis, my colleagues and I and the Committee for the Global Endeavor can arouse interest in the concept without having to be subordinate to some institution, without having to seek opinions. In short, in the intervening time, the entire content of the committee's documents, which amounts to over 200 pages, has been translated into French, and we are about two-thirds through of the translation into Spanish. The concept is that when we have the Spanish translation completed, then we can seek to start arousing interest in countries where Spanish is spoken, which is to say in Latin America and in Spain, and become more active in countries where English and French are spoken. The concept is based on the 12 core of Master Seraphim. We had to design certain adaptations because some of the descriptions of the 12 core strictly do not apply to human beings. But that is the basic concept. And the concept also involves people who would work in the background of human society, who would provide information and advice upon request, who would not make public proposals, who would help innovators, who would help initiators, who would help original thinkers who are seeking to improve their corner of human life in the ways that they find best. But this assistance would be facilitative, it would be optional, it would not be an effort to exert control. In effect, it amounts to a kind of a support program for innovators. And we understand, of course, as the Seraphic Planetary Government undoubtedly understands, that one cannot assume that just because a proposal is new, because it seems innovative, therefore it will work. Many proposals do not work. The progression of human life involves trial and error. So one could look at the proposal for the Global Endeavor as an effort to facilitate and encourage this process of trial and error in society, on the understanding that it is the people in society who have to make proposals and run with them, and that the participants in the future Global Endeavor will be in the background and encouraging them. So essentially, that is where we are. I prepared a very detailed analysis of the work of the Master Seraphim. I think it's 15 pages as a study guide. And at a later stage, when we reach that point, I hope that the participants in this program will be interested in using the questions of that study guide as a framework for discussing the work of the Master Seraphim.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I think that that would be great.
Thank you, Brooklyn.
I would also like to say to introduce Charles, who is on the line with us. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Crystal and Andre, Neil.
Good morning.
Is Paula?
Good morning, Charles.
Today?
Paula is not with us today. Mm-hmm. She's off this weekend.
I didn't think so, but greetings to all of you.
Thank you. Well, we'd like to start reading the first introductory part of paper 114. And Andre, are you on with us?
I am. I haven't been responding, but I would like to just, before I start, just respond and say, sounds very intriguing what you're talking about, Neil, and very well thought out. And look forward to hearing more about this as we unfold this paper, maybe with a view to how you've seen this paper impact your decision to pursue, that endeavor.
Thank you. We will certainly have a chance to talk about that, and I appreciate your comments.
So, having said that, let's charge into Seraphic Planetary Government, paper 114. The Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men through many celestial forces and agencies, but chiefly through the ministry of Seraphim. At noon today, the roll call of planetary angels, guardians, and others on Urantia was 501,234,619 pairs of Seraphim. There were assigned to my command 200 seraphic hosts, 597,196,800 pairs of seraphim, or 1,194,393,600 individual angels. The registry, however, shows 1,002,469,238 individuals. It follows, therefore, that 191,924,362 angels were absent from this world on transport, messenger, and death duty. On Urantia, there are about the same number of cherubim as seraphim, and they are similarly organized. Seraphim and their associated cherubim have much to do with the details of the superhuman government of a planet, especially of worlds which have been isolated by rebellion. The angels, ably assisted by the midwares, function on Urantia as the actual supermaterial ministers who execute the mandates of the resident governor general and all his associates and subordinates. Seraphim as a class are occupied with many assignments other than those of personal and group guardianship. Urantia is not without proper and effective supervision from the system, constellation, and universe rulers. But the planetary government is unlike that of any other world in the Satania system, even in all Nebadon. This uniqueness in your plan of supervision is due to a number of unusual circumstances. 1. The life modification status of Urantia. 2. The exigencies of the Lucifer Rebellion. 3. The disruptions of the Adamic Default. 4. The irregularities growing out of the fact that Urantia was one of the bestowal worlds of the universe sovereign. Michael of Nebadon is the planetary prince of Urantia. 5. The special function of the 24 planetary directors. 6. The location on the planet of an archangel circuit. 7. The more recent designation of the one-time incarnated Machavento Melchizedek as vicegerent planetary prince. And that ends the introduction.
Any comments?
I think that the title of the paper is interesting as a conceptual matter. On the one hand, the title simply states Seraphic Planetary Government. But when we go down into the material that Andre read, we find a reference to the 24 planetary directors and the Governor General. I'm sorry, the Governor General is not mentioned here. So as a matter of drafting, it's interesting that the authors chose to emphasize the role of the Seraphim, not the role of the Governor General, not the role of the Vicegerent Planetary Prince. I don't know whether this is because the other elements of the functioning of the planetary government are less available for us to understand, or whether it is because the Seraphim do the bulk of the work. I don't know what others may feel about that.
Well, I think it's the latter. I've always thought that they are the workhorses of planetary administration and service. And because of that, they predominate, they prevail. They have to execute, carry out universe policy, local universe system and constellation policy. This list of seven includes a number of conditions. They wouldn't be governing.
Right.
Life modification, the consequences of Lucifer, the Adamic default, the intervention of Machiavelli Melchizedek. That's not a condition, but that's one individual who did something extraordinary. It wouldn't be, it's an eventuation of government, but to govern you need to have a bureaucracy. In this case we have a powerful but benevolent and efficient, proficient bureaucracy, which would be angelic, etc. So it doesn't surprise me, but I think your noting it, Neil, is appropriate and significant conceptually, that the it highlights the meaning and value of angelic work.
Thank you. In considering the role of the Seraphic Planetary Government, it's also important to understand that the author of this paper is the Chief of Seraphim. All right. But this
that doesn't
chief
happen
of Seraph-
everywhere in the chief- book either. That's noteworthy as well.
Exactly. And this Chief of Seraphim is not a Seraphim. This
right.
Chief of Seraphim is a primary Supernaphim of Paradise. At the beginning of paper 27, the author of that paper, a perfecter of wisdom, states that it is the policy of the government of the sons for the father to put a primary Supernaphim in charge of the Seraphim on any world that is in rebellion immediately after a Paradise Son has been bestowed to that world. And so I'm now referring to a passage on page 298 of the one-column edition, which in turn is the second paragraph in paper 27. And it states...
Section
0.
Okay.
Yeah, the introductory
section. The introductory section at the beginning of the paper. And in the second paragraph, it reads as follows. Primary Supernaphim are also placed in command of the Seraphic hosts ministering on worlds isolated because of rebellion. When a Paradise Son is bestowed upon such a world, completes his mission, ascends to the Universal Father, is accepted, and returns as the accredited deliverer of this isolated world, a primary Supernaphim is always designated by the chiefs of assignment to assume command of the ministering spirits on duty in the newly reclaimed sphere. Supernaphim in this special service are periodically rotated. On Urantia, the present chief of Seraphim is the second of this order to be on duty since the times of the bestowal of Christ Michael. So we now have a comment on the individual, the primary Supernaphim, who is in this role as chief of seraphim and who wrote the paper that we are beginning to read, paper 114. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there might be comment from any of my colleagues today on why a primary Supernaphim will be chosen for this function.
I think the first and foremost aspect would be the guarantee of loyalty, the absolute assurance that there would be no opportunity for default and much less rebellion on the part of a primary Supernaphim. There just wouldn't be that possibility. And considering perhaps how closely they associate with ascending mortals much later on, they have a view to where everything is supposed to be heading on the planet. They know what mortals are supposed to be eventually. They know what the high destiny is going to be by virtue of close association with ascending mortals much later in Havona and on Paradise. And that would afford them a lot of experience as well. Those would be the two primary reasons that come to my mind, but I'm sure there are others.
Well, my thinking is, in addition to what you said, Andre, is the universe has a system of checks and balances based on separation of powers. It runs throughout the Urantia book's description of the universe of universes, the master universe. And so the sending of a primary Supernaphim would fit accordingly. And for all the reasons you gave, and no doubt additional reasons, you want to have a greater adult, so to speak, in terms of status and authority and experience and skill.
Someone who is dependable to withstand any type of rebellion, ongoing or future.
Yes, well, they may have been able to find somebody within the context of the local universe that would literally fit that description, but they're not taking any chances because it affects us. We're their children. We're their charges. And the universe authorities on all levels would want to be assured in a post-rebellion framework that greater experience is brought to bear. There's too much at stake to...
Right.
And it suggests to me that in previous rebellions that was done. But this system of checks and balances and separation of powers reflected in the American Republic's Constitution seems to be, from our point of view, revelatory and essential in terms of reliable authority. Somebody who is completely reliable, as you were stating, Andre.
If I can briefly interject on that, I think that's a wonderful point that you're making as well, and it's a concept that never occurred to me in quite the terms. I might label that as there is a policy of no double jeopardy for a planet that has mm-hmm. once been subjected to rebellion. That is to say, you know, we still have to evolve through, and we'll have our ups and downs here, as we are now, clearly. But there is no chance for a second rebellion from above to intervene or supervene and take hold of us. So that there's actually some tremendous comfort in that. Thank you for that, Charles.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Neil.
Thank you. I agree with everything that both of you have been saying. I would add, in effect, a comment on the character of witness that the primary Supernaphim offers. A primary Supernaphim is the direct progeny of the Infinite Spirit. Hmm. Immediately of experience on Paradise. If you recall, one of the great... defects, one of the great lies of the Lucifer rebellion was Lucifer's claim that the Paradise Father is a myth, created by the Creator Son. Well, a primary supernatum has immediate personal experience that refutes that. Origin in paradise, immediate descent from the infinite spirit, obviously a close awareness of the Father as a spiritual presence. So a primary supernatum has the personal standing to be able to refute anyone at any level of the government of Urantia, or for that matter, at a higher level of the local universe if necessary, in regard to the spiritual realities that the Paradise Trinity represents. The reality of the Father, the reality of the Eternal Son, and certainly the reality of the Infinite Spirit. This person, a primary supernatum, has the personal level of knowledge and experience that makes her, and I say her, a commanding presence in regard to all the subordinate intelligences and ministering angels of the local universe who are assigned to Urantia. It amounts to an escalation of merit and an escalation of standing that gives the Chief of Seraphim unquestioned authority.
Yes,
and added also no baggage.
Right.
She would come here without any baggage. There must have been a tremendous... When these angels rebelled, when the ones rebelled and the ones that considered rebelling and then didn't or did, and the ones that never considered it, there must have been a great deal of angst between them for a period of time. They had probably never, I'm guessing, they probably never encountered deception, lies, fraud, atheism, an atheistic declaration from Lucifer, and someone so articulate and brilliant. It must have been difficult for them. In a certain sense, they had a certain kind of innocence, cosmic innocence, if my reasoning is sound. And I would think they had many arguments. They argue anyway, the same as we do. They don't argue bitterly, but they do debate. And this must have been some heck of a debate over these lies and fraudulent con artist that I consider Lucifer to be, a liar and a cheat. He would cheat us of our relationship to the Father. A grim, grim intrusion in the ascension scheme. So these angels must have been through, must have put themselves through quite a ringer. So you'd have to have, in order to reestablish order among the loyal seraphim, and among seraphim generally from the local universe, and even among the master seraphim, you need somebody, you're right, Neil, of tremendous authority. But they would, having no baggage of any kind in any of this, would keep them entirely free, it would seem to me, of any second guessing or that sort of thing, in picking somebody more local.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that, and I would add that the timing of the arrival of the first primary supernatum is very significant. In the passage from paper 27 that I read earlier, it stated that this happens just after the Paradise Son completes his bestowal. I think one of the key elements of that is not simply that this is the beginning of a new dispensation, but it is also the beginning of new planetary potentials in a spiritual sense. From that point onward, all human beings of normal standing who can discern right and wrong receive thought adjusters. The policy for ascension into the mansion worlds changes in terms of the eligibility of human beings. And in effect, it seems to me that the completion of the bestowal mission of the Paradise Son involves an upstepping of spiritual energy that is available to the inhabitants of the planet for all these reasons, and probably for yet other reasons that we do not understand. And so a primary supernatum has a better ability to grasp all these possibilities and to seek to bring them into balance, which of course is a very severe challenge after a rebellion.
Well, I would like to recommend that we read on with the next section. Would anyone else like to read?
Sure.
Thanks, Charles.
Number one. The original sovereignty of the rancher was held in trust by the sovereign of the Satania system. It was first delegated by him to a joint commission of Melchizedeks and life carriers. And this group functioned on Urantia until the arrival of a regularly constituted planetary prince. Subsequent to the downfall of Prince Caligastri at the time of the Lucifer Rebellion, Urantia had no sure and settled relationship with the local universe and its administrative divisions until the completion of Michael's bestowal in the flesh, when he was proclaimed by the Union of Days planetary prince of Urantia. Such a proclamation in surety and in principle forever settled the status of your world. But in practice, the sovereign creator son made no gesture of personal administration of the planet aside from the establishment of the Jerusalem Commission of 24 former Urantians with authority to represent him in the government of Urantia and in all other quarantine planets in the system. One of this council is now always resident on Urantia as resident governor general. Vicegerent authority to act for Michael as planetary prince has been recently vested in Machaventi Melchizedek, but this son of the local universe has made not the slightest move toward modifying the present planetary regime of the successive administrations of the resident governors general. There is little likelihood that any marked change will be made in the government of Urantia during the present dispensation unless the vicegerent planetary prince should arrive to assume his titular responsibilities. It appears to certain of our associates that at some time in the near future the plan of sending one of the 24 councils to Urantia to act as governor general will be superseded by the formal arrival of Machaventi Melchizedek with the vicegerent mandate of the sovereignty of Urantia. As acting planetary prince, he would undoubtedly continue in charge of the planet until the final adjudication of the Lucifer Rebellion and probably on into the distant future of planetary settlement in life and light. Some believe that Machaventi will not come to take personal direction of Urantian affairs until the end of the current dispensation. Others hold that the vicegerent prince may not come as such until Michael sometime returns to Urantia, as he promised when still in the flesh. Still others, including this narrator, look for Machaventi's appearance any day or hour.
You just gotta love that last line.
Mm-hmm.
Any day or hour. For that to be said by a high Supernophim, someone whose view, and if we could only begin to imagine the mind of a Supernophim and just how all-encompassing, how truly enormous, what they're able to include in that. This is not a lightly held opinion. After analyzing absolutely everything, it's occurred to her that she just doesn't know when Machaventi could come. It could be any time based on any number of factors. That's astounding.
The other thing I find interesting about that, too, is that she gives everyone else's opinion first and states her own as a latter.
That is very close to the idea that I was going to express and will proceed. It exemplifies the willingness of the authors of this document, the Fifth Epical Revelation, to encourage diverse opinions and to record that there are diverse opinions. So
yeah.
by implication, this author and other authors are telling us that it is perfectly acceptable to have different points of view on spiritual matters. The previous ecclesiastical religious tradition of the West emphasized uniformity of belief, and as a consequence generated tremendous controversies and indeed persecutions. The authors of these papers are telling us that uniformity of belief is not required, that it is perfectly appropriate and indeed welcome to express diverse views.
I think it also reflects, to go back to the nature of our planetary government, its organic and nonlinear constitution. Organic is usually in distinction with or contrast to administration. And administration tends to be linear. Policies are formulated, executed according to rules, laws, regulations, etc. And we undoubtedly have those features, although on a higher level. But our situation is unique, one of a kind, and also in some ways not unique, similar to other planets of rebellion. So it's compounded even more. And in order to, it's a measure, I think, that last paragraph, Andre, that you reacted so interestingly to, it's a measure, I think, of how not only unsettled we are, but how organic and nonlinear the solution has to be in governing this world. And if they succeed here, they'll succeed elsewhere, in a manner of speaking. So I suppose that your answer is under that kind of a limelight, and why we have so many visitors of all kinds and probably all levels of interest to what's going on here. It's it's interesting. They are struggling. It seems to me that they're struggling in the benign sense, in the positive, affirmative sense, with how to continually adjust policy to the Urantian situation in governing our world.
The fluidity of Urantian situation.
My respect goes even higher. I mean, every time I can reflect upon this, my respect soars for them. I'm comforted by their love and affection, but I'm also comforted by their skill, their proficiency, organically or in a nonlinear sense. And hence making predictions is highly problematic, even for high and powerful beings.
Indeed. And, you know, it seems so much a part of human nature that we try to predict how the, you know, as Neil was talking about earlier at the beginning of the show, you know, sort of predicting what's going to happen with Japan or with Russia or with the USSR, with China, and we have experts who come on the air, on programs with the media, and predict, you know, what's going to happen with various very complex challenges around the world. And those always amuse me. Like, there's so many different elements to take into consideration that we're just not in the position to be able to predict most of these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they're doing so from the viewpoint of what they perceive literally to be the laws of social science, among other laws, let alone any kind of spiritual laws that may be functioning that we would be completely ignorant of. But, you know, whereas we've looked at social science as a soft science, the Urantia book has presented to us in the papers in the history of Urantia just preceding this in the 80s and early 90s, those papers are really papers designed to solidify how important social science is as a science, and how there are laws to be at least at first gleaned, if not actually known, that function in terms of human mass interactions at various levels. And imagine if you have that kind of knowledge, what your predictive capability is. There are many things that they can see coming down the pike that we're completely ignorant of and would not be able to see until we begin to really believe, as they did, say, at the end of the 19th century, that there there is such a thing as laws of social science, which we then, over the subsequent 50 years following that, gradually softened and put out of favor the social scientists of that bygone era because of what they were associated with, because of their calling themselves social Darwinists and such. You know, without digressing too much, that's a significant aspect to keep in mind, is that there are so many laws, I mean literal laws, that we are ignorant of that have nothing to do with physical law.
That the angels abide by, or that they rule.
That they're completely conversant with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, go ahead, Neil.
Oh, sorry, Charles. One of the implications of this discussion at the end of the section that you read, Charles, has to do with the timing of group events of major significance. And it somewhat reminds me of discussion among readers of the Urantia book as to why this material suddenly loomed into print and what was being sought as a consequence of that bestowal of an epical revelation in written form. If we compare the production and the publication of the Urantia book with the narrative in the paper on planetary mortal epochs, we do not find that it is normally the policy of issuing a revelation in written form.
Right.
Right.
This is extremely unusual. And so, just as a speculation, it seems to me that providing this revelation in written form was at least partly intended to achieve certain changes in humanity that are required before we humanity collectively and we humanity as individual spiritual beings can progress to the next stage. That we have to achieve something in terms of our personal and collective development. And so now I come back to this paragraph. What are the preconditions for Melchizedek deciding to arrive? We do not know, but it is at least reasonable to speculate that he will come when the conditions are right, and that part of this factor of motivating his decision will be achievements of human beings, or at least achievements of human society and civilization, which the seraphic planetary government is encouraging.
I see it that way too. I think that there must be several conditions at the moment, and when I say at the moment, I would say like within the last 100-year period of time, that must have seemed potentially appropriate for this kind of information to be revealed. And the fact that there aren't thousands of people sort of rushing to find this information is to many of us a real confusing. You know, we can't really understand why more people wouldn't be interested in this. But when you think about this from the long-term viewpoint, it's probably pretty amazing to them that as many people are engaged in these discussions as there are.
Interesting points. And let me just identify and say that you're listening to The Cosmic Citizen. Today's program is Seraphic Planetary Government, Work of the Master Seraphim. And today on the program we have Crystalline, we have Neil, and we have Charles. And Charles, you're about to speak.
Oh, thank you, Andre. The existence of the reserve corps of destiny is a measure of how difficult it is for the seraphic planetary administration to predict human behavior. And in the last paragraph of Section 6, the following is stated. Let's see. Aside from these many means of positive action, referencing what Master Seraphim do generally, the Master Seraphim ensure planetary progress against vital jeopardy through the mobilization, training, and maintenance of the Reserve Corps of Destiny. And the next sentence is very interesting in that light. The chief function of these reservists is to ensure against breakdown revolutionary progress. They are the provisions which the celestial forces have made against surprise. They are the guarantees against disaster. So it's an insurance policy. Mm. And I think this is so because you can review and assess many factors of the present moment that have, from the point of view of the long view, and see how they're going to play out in the future, how they may play out in the future. But you can't really factor in free will, given it's subjective, not just because it's not an objective factor particularly. It may have some aspects like that, but it's primarily subjective. So human beings will disappoint, will fail, will be defeated. Now, they know this, but I don't know how you could factor that in. Free will is, by definition, is a conceptual reality that allows choosing in any one of a number of directions in spite of apparent logic, reasoning. And so it's messy trying to minister to beings like us. It's problematic, messy in the sense it's so problematic. And the Reserve Corps is that it's necessary from their point of view, the long view, is a measure of this, over and above all the other unique aspects of your rancher.
Well, I would like to suggest we read on, because we have so much material to cover, so much rich and deep material to cover. I would like to read the Board of Planetary Supervisors, if we don't have any other urgent comments.
Read on.
Okay. So, Section 2, the Board of Planetary Supervisors, and I want to also add to our station identification that we're looking at paper 114 of the Urantia book, which is called The Seraphic Planetary Government, for our listeners. Section 2, the Board of Planetary Supervisors. Since the times of Michael's bestowal on your world, the general management of Urantia has been entrusted to a special group on Jerozem of 24 one-time Urantians. Qualification for membership on this commission is unknown to us, but we have observed that those who have been thus commissioned have all been contributors to the enlarging sovereignty of the Supreme in the system of Satania. By nature, they were all real leaders when they functioned on Urantia, and, excepting Machiaventa Melchizedek, these qualities of leadership have been further augmented by mansion world experience and supplemented by the training of Jerozem citizenship. Members are nominated to the 24 by the Cabinet of Lanaforge, seconded by the Most Highs of Edentia, approved by the assigned Sentinel of Jerozem, and appointed by Gabriel of Salvington in accordance with the mandate of Michael. The temporary appointees function just as fully as do the permanent members of this commission of special supervisors. This board of planetary directors is especially concerned with the supervision of those activities on this world which result from the fact that Michael here experienced his terminal bestowal. They are kept in close and immediate touch with Michael by the liaison activities of a certain brilliant evening star, the identical being who attended upon Jesus throughout the mortal bestowal. At the present time, one John, known to you as the Baptist, is chairman of this council when it is in session on Jerusalem. But the ex officio head of this council is the assigned sentinel of Satania, the direct and personal representative of the associate inspector on Salvington, and of the supreme executive of Orvantan. The members of this same commission of former Urantians also act as advisory supervisors of the 36 other rebellion-isolated worlds of the system. They perform a very valuable service in keeping Lanaforge, the system sovereign, in close and sympathetic touch with the affairs of these planets, which still remain more or less under the over-control of the Constellation Fathers of Norlashadek. These 24 counselors make frequent trips, as individuals, to each of the quarantined planets, especially to Urantia. Each of the other isolated worlds is supervised by similar and varying-sized commissions of its one-time inhabitants, but these other commissions are subordinate to the Urantia group of 24. While the members of the latter commission are thus actively interested in every phase of human progress on each quarantine world in Satania, they are especially and particularly concerned with the welfare and advancement of the mortal races of Urantia, for they immediately and directly supervise the affairs of none of the planets except Urantia. And even here, their authority is not complete, excepting in certain domains concerned with mortal survival. No one knows how long these 24 Urantia counselors will continue in their present status, detached from the regular program of universe activities. They will no doubt continue to serve in their present capacities until some change in planetary status ensues, such as the end of a dispensation, the assumption of full authority by Machiaventa Melchizedek, the final adjudication of the Lucifer Rebellion, or the reappearance of Michael on the world of his final bestowal. The present resident Governor General of Urantia seems inclined to the opinion that all but Machiaventa may be released for Paradise Ascension the moment the system of Satania is restored to the constellation circuits. But other opinions are also current.
There's that point that you made, Neil, underscored by that last sentence again. They're wanting to let us know that everybody has their opinion. They may hold it strongly, but there you have it. There are many opinions. A lot of fascinating stuff in here. Who would like to jump in? Well, Neil, why don't have you jump in?
Okay.
I could jump in. I could dominate for the next 20 minutes. So I'm holding myself back.
I applaud your self-restraint. I would like to focus attention on the last phrase, the last two lines of the second last paragraph, because it talks about what specifically the group of 24 supervise. It says, even here, their authority, that is to say, even on Urantia, their authority is not complete, excepting in certain domains concerned with mortal survival. All
yeah.
Right, now, who would like to speculate what these domains may be?
Well, I'd love to just point out one thing. We know that only the Ancients of Days can decree the non-survival of anyone. Therefore, it's clear that this has to do with when survival may be in question, on possibly saying, no, this one definitely goes forward. and being able to forward at least that opinion that that a mortal that may be of questionable survival status, who may be up for adjudication by the Ancients of Days, the mercy plan is always in operation. So that it fascinates me from that standpoint. I have trouble envisioning what else it could have to do with, but that may be linearity on my part. I'm sure you have other opinions.
In connection with the adjudication by the Ancients of Days, there are descriptions in other passages which state that their decisions are based on the recommendations of all the various tribunals who have examined the cases involved, starting at the planet of Nativity, continuing through the local universe right up to the Ancients of Days. And so the Ancients of Days determination are not based on an initial trial of evidence pertaining to an individual. Instead, they function as a kind of a review body, or if you prefer, an appeal body, in going through the accumulated recommendations. And so if I am going to speculate about certain domains concerned with mortal survival, my speculation would pertain to the ways in which the life of a human being is reviewed here on the part of the spiritual persons who are participating in that review, for which they will subsequently make recommendations. But I'm just speculating.
Be interested to hear some of the details on that. But Charles, do you have an opinion yet?
Well, it's in line with yours. I see it. First of all, they could speak to mercy, have a mercy ministry, because of the experiences of all of them. They have the wonderful combination of a ground up viewpoint and a top down perspective, having survived, going right back to the various racial prophets, when the races were individualized, and coming right on down to John the Baptist. So what makes it interesting is they made an exception to the Maccabenti, but the list includes a midwayer, and that's interesting to me. That gives it a different point of view than a human experiential viewpoint. It gives it a longer planetary experiential viewpoint. And what I had in mind, Moses, Enoch, I looked at Adam and Eve. That gives us still another point of view. They came here, but then they died here. And I think worlds in rebellion are such basket cases, like ours, there's such basket cases that you have to get the richest, the universe wants to get the richest possible insights born through experience, living in a world like this, and from different angles, midwayer, human, Adamic, etc., and even Melchizedek. It indicates again how what a basket case we are. And how much love and intelligence service is needed to make this, put this world back on a proper track. And even in that process, it becomes, as Neil suggested earlier, a new kind of track. It has to be. All types of adjustments are needed. And it reflects the universe, the wisdom of universe policymakers in valuing experience and the importance of experience. It gives still another example just how meaningful experience, worthwhile experience can be, and how essential it is to integrate that into policy and the execution of policy, the carrying out of policy. And we're vulnerable. We mortals are vulnerable. So mercy is, a lot is covered by mercy. Mercy is an extraordinary concept. I think time itself is mercy. It allows beings like us to exist of a certain kind. And it's a in law, to use a legal phrase, using the 4 and 20 would be a mitigating aspect to rehabilitating your rancher.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Andre, well, and Carol, or and Crystal, and if you permit, I'd like to go on to another sentence that particularly strikes me as interesting, if that's all right.
Sure.
Near the bottom of page 1251, the last paragraph starts with a sentence that says, quote, "This board of planetary directors is especially concerned with the supervision of those activities on this world which result from the fact that Michael here experienced his terminal bestowal." Okay, now I have an initial question about that. When they say those activities on this world, do they mean those activities among human beings or those activities on the spiritual level of supervision of this world that the seraphim and others participate in? In other words, what is going on either level, either the human level or the seraphic government level, because Michael had his terminal bestowal here on Urantia?
Well, excellent question. I'm pondering it, but someone jump in.
Well, I'm just thinking, I find it very touching that in the list of the 4 and 20 that John the Baptist was picked.
Yeah.
I'm fairly convinced that Michael, that was a personal, he made it clear to me, my guess is he made it clear to Gabriel that was a personal touch. What the criteria were for these particular individuals, there may have been others, Wynad Van, for example, or Ramadan, that was used to pick these particular ones, I think is another interesting and fascinating question that hints at, again, how universe policy is formed and carried out. But the picking of John the Baptist, who was Michael's forebearer, they were friends, they were cousins, they were brothers in the spirit. There's something wonderfully beautiful, wonderfully touching about that, loving about
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows to me that, again, there's something profoundly personal about how the universe, how higher beings and mid beings and mid levels and lower spirit beings operate.
Mm-hmm.
And it reflects loyalty. It gives another example of how deep and rich loyalty is so highly valued that Michael would include John the Baptist. I do not know if he hadn't, whom else he would have replaced him by, and what the effect that would have been. But he didn't. He picked his forebearer, his cousin in the flesh, his brother in the spirit in the flesh, a man who yielded his life in loyal service to Jesus
mm-hmm.
and then to Michael. And I'm deeply moved and comforted that the administration of a wayward planet could be carried out on some levels that are so personal, so touchingly emotional and spiritual and social, but so personal. I find this the poetry in prose that are mentioned on the in Marantia Life in that list of 24. This is the poetry of the routine prose of universe administration. This is living poetry that John the Baptist was picked. What a tribute! What an action of loyalty and what love and what beauty there is in that. And all of us are equally loved.
Mm-hmm.
We're equally cherished individually, personally, by Michael
yeah.
and by the Father and by the angels who know us and personally. It's very rich. It's very beautiful. I think it's true and it's very good. And I'm very moved by it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful point you're making, and what strikes me about it as well is, you know, we know that John the Baptist was nothing like a perfect preacher. His message was not astounding. His achievement had to do with simply being the forerunner of Jesus and of course assembling a group that was loyal to him, obviously because he showed loyalty to those that were following him. But the fact that it wasn't achievement-based, you know, when I think of corporate climbing, you know, I think of the kinds of achievements, or Neil, I'm sure you can speak to the idea of climbing the rungs of the ladders of government service. This seems, the idea, again, and I'm equally touched by that, the idea of what Jesus referred in terms of messages in life, alluding to what Jesus surely knew was coming up for John in the next life, but what John could not even begin to guess at, and that this was all coming, if there was any trait that was earning him this, it was simply his loyalty and faith. That is astounding.
I would like to comment that because we're down to the last half hour, I'd like to skip the next two sections with the exception of just the last three paragraphs of the Most High Observer. And then I'd like to ask Neil if you'd read the Planetary Government, the Section 5.
Crystal, I'm willing to do that, but I had assumed that we were going to spend more than 1 week on this paper. Am I incorrect?
Oh, we definitely are.
Yeah, it might be good not to you know, move too hastily through some of this stuff, because this particular section, for one thing, is very, very rich. There are a lot of implications to this section that have to do with the Planetary Government that we haven't even touched upon. One that I might point out just as an aside is that the ex officio head of this council is the assigned sentinel of Satania, who himself represents, well, the associate inspector on Salvington, but the supreme executive Orvontan, who literally over controls not only Orvontan, but every related segment in the master universe, eventually. This is a high being, and they describe the supreme executive Orvontan as literally hearing, seeing, and feeling all in Orvontan.
Well, I have no objection to covering the entire paper. I mean, the paper in its entirety. And I would sort of be happy to come back to it. I have a little bit of method to my madness in that we have a program that's coming up next week that's going to interrupt the paper to talk about an event that's happening at the headquarters of the Archangel for the entire local universe. And
well, I'm certain. Certainly amenable to that, and considering we don't have much time, let's perhaps move on that way. If unless somebody had a burning desire to make one comment before we do move on,
and I'd be happy to read through these sections, you know, the next time we discuss this.
Okay.
But I really want to get to the Planetary Government and the Master Seraphim section, just to at least read through it on this show before we have Diane on next week to talk about.
I defer to you, Sister Crystalline.
Guys, do either of you have any other comments you want to make on that?
I just wonder whether Andre has now given a habit to Crystalline when he called her Sister Crystalline.
I'm imagining the flying nun, Sally Field, for those of you who remember.
I think Crystalline will decline that honor, actually. But
I will, in fact, decline that honor.
I don't object, but I'm a little bit puzzled at the sequence of events because, as all of you know, one of the documents that I prepared in the context of the work of the Committee for the Global Endeavor is a very detailed study guide to the work of the Master Seraphim. It runs on, I think, about 15 pages. And I was hoping that we could use that study guide as the vehicle for an extended discussion of the work of the Master Seraphim, which in turn corresponds to Section 6 of this paper. But I don't know how that fits in with the program that Crystalline has just explained.
Well, I am hoping to do that the following week.
Okay.
So,
but you would nevertheless like to do a preview of Section 6 today? Is that
exactly
the idea?
Exactly.
All right.
And I,
what about
I wanted
the intervening sections?
Well, we've got less than a half hour left. So I think even if we read quickly, we will be challenged to do that.
Well, so, if I can just suggest what I think Crystalline is saying is that we'll jump to 6, we'll come back and fully consider these other sections before, and I was certainly hoping that we would delve into your study of Section 6 using your format once we had built up to it going through this. It seems like this has just evolved nicely that way. So maybe it won't be, you know, following right away, but we will get to that and we'll build up to it by making sure to cover what the authors had put ahead of that section in preparation for it.
I'm very happy with the replies that Crystalline and Andre have just given. Are you in agreement, Charles?
Yes. The only thing I would like to avoid is being too much in a hurry.
Absolutely.
There's rarely any, unless there's a fire or some other emergency, there is rarely ever any true necessity
week,
for that. We live in a frantic civilization, and I don't care to accommodate that aspect. But
the only thing that we're constrained by is that next week, at the first hour of the program, Diane is going to be coming on to talk about her event next summer, or this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is my intention to create a platform for her to speak on for that period of time next week, and then to come back to our more in-depth study.
Okay, the subsequent hour?
Right.
Okay.
And then then for the next couple of shows after that.
Right, of course, yeah.
That's a fair
Okay, very good.
So if I net all this out, I think the last request was from Crystalline for me to start reading Section 6, am I right?
Well, I wanted to start with Section 5, but I also wanted to read the beginning, paragraph 4,
Section
4, paragraph 3. In a crisis, the actual and sovereign head of the government accepting in certain purely spiritual matters would be this Verondadex son of Adentia, now on observation duty. And then to skip down, the Most High Observer is empowered at his discretion to seize the planetary government in times of grave planetary crisis. And it is of record that this has happened 33 times in the history of Urantia. At such times, the Most High Observer functions as Most High Regent, exercising unquestioned authority over all ministers and administrators resident on the planet, excepting only the divisional organization of the archangels. The Verondadex regencies are not peculiar to rebellion-isolated planets, for the Most Highs may intervene at any time in the affairs of the inhabited worlds, interposing the superior wisdom of the constellation rulers in the affairs of the kingdoms of men.
In the paragraphs that Crystalline has just read, the number 33 times leaps out at me. Personally, I would be inclined to interpret that as pertaining to the entire history of our planet as an inhabited planet. In other words, 33 times since the era of Andon and Fanta. I do not
right.
think that we should restrict this just to 33 times since the Planetary Rebellion, much less 33 times during the past few centuries. I think they're talking about the entire history of Urantia as an inhabited planet since the time of Andon and Fanta, and I wonder if others agree with that.
It sounds reasonable to me.
It does, but the rebellion was so extraordinary that they describe evolutionary life the first more or less 800,000 years as proceeding along nicely and thereafter. And there may have been crises that are not described in this book that occurred there, but I would tend to think the majority of those would have been post-rebellion because of the extraordinary nature of the extraordinarily traumatic nature that it had in this world.
And because it happened so early on in our planetary evolution.
We were just talking about how complicated the planetary government is and why. Largely because of the effects of the rebellion, and the default, which is another effect in and of itself.
Go ahead.
I've also speculated since the Second World War, in the early 1950s, we probably came closest to a thermonuclear exchange, and around 1962. Correct me if I'm wrong, Neil. General Curtis LeMay, I believe he was in that year chairman of the Joint Chiefs, made a statement to President Kennedy in reference, in the context of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that if a thermonuclear exchange occurred, there would be 800 million dead in the first month or so, mostly in the Northern Hemisphere. And I wondered how the Master Seraphim handled that and how the Most High Observer handled that. Because on the one hand, you have two forces with the capacity to cause 800 million fatalities and probably far in excess of a billion wounded casualties. And yet that could not be permitted for the amount of damage it would have done on the one hand. On the other hand, you have human free will functioning. So the Most High and all the others had to deal with the tension between human free will running these governments and threatening each other with nuclear deterrence. And perhaps I know that some people on both sides seriously considered it, and yet not directly violating free will. One heck of a problem. And I could see, I'm speculating, obviously, the Most High seizing control at some point when the thermonuclear exchange became most imminent or closest to being carried out.
Charles, I think you've asked a number of very interesting questions. I agree with you that there was probably some kind of an emergency mobilization of the Seraphic Planetary Government at the time to prevent a terrible catastrophe, or maybe I should say a huge catastrophe instead of just being terrible. It is reasonable to speculate that there may have been a regency at that point. You mentioned also about the Reserve Corps of Destiny being the emergency personnel that the Seraphic Planetary Government can draw on. There is a reference in an earlier paper, I should say, that deals with an earlier period. Paper 109, near the end of it, it's right at the bottom of page 1201 in the single column edition, near the end of section 7 of paper 109. It states that there was a regency relatively recently as compared with the time in which the revelation was given, which is to say in the middle 1930s. And here's the paragraph. It reads, "When the planetary Verandadec observer of Urantia, the most high custodian who not long since assumed an emergency regency of your world, asserted his authority in the presence of the resident governor general, he began his emergency administration of Urantia with a full staff of his own choosing. He immediately assigned to all his associates and assistants their planetary duties, but he did not choose the three personalized adjusters who appeared in his presence the instant he assumed the regency. He did not even know they would thus appear, for they did not so manifest their divine presence at the time of a previous regency. And the Most High Regent did not assign service or designate duties for these volunteer personalized adjusters. Nevertheless, these three omnipersonal beings were among the most active of the numerous orders of celestial beings then serving on Urantia." Well, back to the chronology, this establishes, in my opinion, that there was a regency at some point in the previous several decades, probably between the year 1900 and the year 1930. At least that would be my guess. Did it coincide perhaps with World War I? Maybe so. We don't know. But it also states that the personnel involved in these regencies may vary, because in this case, the regency that the author, A Solitary Messenger, is describing, there were three personalized adjusters who became part of the staff, whereas in previous regencies, there were not such reinforcements. So Peter's speculation about a possible regency at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 is an interesting one. I think he makes a very plausible case, but of course we will never know. And the fact that there might have been a regency then, and that there certainly appears to have been one in the early years of the 1900s, suggests that he was also right in inferring that the pace of regencies has probably accelerated substantially since the rebellion, in the sense that the affairs of our planet have been more complicated and more delicate.
Thank you, Neil.
It's quite a compelling statement. Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
I'd like to suggest that you, if you don't mind, Neil, why don't you read Section 5 and Section 6 together then?
Okay.
Because Section 5 is relatively short, and just continue on reading.
Thank you. Section 5 in paper 114. Does anyone wish to make a comment before I begin? Because this will go on for quite a while.
I do. Crystal, I think it might make more sense, because we've been reading and then commenting, which makes a lot of sense, to have Neil read just 5 in the 15 minutes or so we have left, to leave some time for comment. Otherwise, I'm concerned it might become a little too linear.
All right. Okay.
If that's agreeable for you.
Or back to Crystalline's earlier point of providing a certain preview for Diane's work next week, maybe go to Section 6. What do you think, Crystalline?
Okay, that would be all right.
So
let's do that.
Charles, I agree with you that we can't skip this material or neglect it or just jump around totally, but I think the earlier discussion implied that we will return to this and will indeed discuss it at a later point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I'm amenable to going to 6. Let's do that. We only have 14 minutes.
All right.
It's all good.
Section 6, the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision. When the first Governor General arrived on Urantia, concurrent with the outpouring of the Spirit of Truth, he was accompanied by 12 corps of Special Seraphim, Seraphington graduates, who were immediately assigned to certain special planetary services. These exalted angels are known as the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision, and are, aside from the over-control of the Planetary Most High Observer, under the immediate direction of the Resident Governor General. These 12 groups of angels, while functioning under the general supervision of the Resident Governor General, are immediately directed by the Seraphic Council of 12, the acting chiefs of each group. This council also serves as the volunteer cabinet of the resident Governor General. As Planetary Chief of Seraphim, I preside over this council of Seraphic Chiefs, and I am a volunteer Supernaphim of the Primary Order, serving on Urantia as the successor of the one-time chief of the angelic host of the planet, who defaulted at the time of the Caligastia succession. The 12 corps of the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision are functional on Urantia as follows. 1. The Epical Angels. These are the angels of the current age, the dispensational group. These celestial ministers are entrusted with the oversight and direction of the affairs of each generation as they are designed to fit into the mosaic of the age in which they occur. The present corps of epical angels serving on Urantia is the third group assigned to the planet during the current dispensation. 2. The Progress Angels. These seraphim are entrusted with the task of initiating the evolutionary progress of the successive social ages. They foster the development of the inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures. They labor incessantly to make things what they ought to be. The group now on duty is the second to be assigned to the planet. 3. The Religious Guardians. These are the angels of the churches, the earnest contenders for that which is and has been. They endeavor to maintain the ideals of that which has survived for the sake of the safe transit of moral values from one epoch to another. They are the checkmates of the angels of progress, all the while seeking to translate from one generation to another the imperishable values of the old and passing forms into the new and therefore less stabilized patterns of thought and conduct. These angels do contend for spiritual forms, but they are not the source of ultra-sectarianism and meaningless controversial divisions of professed religionists. The corps now functioning on Urantia is the fifth, thus to serve. 4. The Angels of Nation Life. These are the angels of the trumpets, directors of the political performances of Urantia national life. The group now functioning in the over-control of international relations is the fourth corps to serve on the planet. It is particularly through the ministry of this seraphic division that the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. 5. The Angels of the Races. Those who work for the conservation of the evolutionary races of time, regardless of their political entanglements and religious groupings. On Urantia, there are remnants of 9 human races which have commingled and combined into the peoples of modern times. These seraphim are closely associated with the Ministry of the Race Commissioners, and the group now on Urantia is the original corps assigned to the planet soon after the Day of Pentecost. 6. The Angels of the Future. These are the projection angels who forecast a future age and plan for the realization of the better things of a new and advancing dispensation. They are the architects of the successive eras. The group now on the planet has thus functioned since the beginning of the current dispensation. 7. The Angels of Enlightenment. Urantia is now receiving the help of the third corps of seraphim dedicated to the fostering of planetary education. These angels are occupied with mental and moral training as it concerns individuals, families, groups, schools, communities, nations, and whole races. 8. The Angels of Health. These are the seraphic ministers assigned to the assistance of those mortal agencies dedicated to the promotion of health and the prevention of disease. The present corps is the sixth group to serve during this dispensation. 9. The Home Seraphim. Urantia now enjoys the services of the fifth group of angelic ministers dedicated to the preservation and advancement of the home, the basic institution of human civilization. 10. The Angels of Industry. This seraphic group is concerned with fostering industrial development and improving economic conditions among the Urantia peoples. This corps has been 7 times changed since the bestowal of Michael. 11. The Angels of Diversion. These are the seraphim who foster the values of play, humor, and rest. They ever seek to uplift man's recreational diversions and thus to promote the more profitable utilization of human leisure. The present corps is the third of that order to minister on your rancho. 12. The angels of superhuman ministry. These are the angels of the angels, those seraphim who are assigned to the ministry of all other superhuman life on the planet, temporary or permanent. This corps has served since the beginning of the current dispensation. When these groups of master seraphim disagree in matters of planetary policy or procedure, their differences are usually composed by the Governor General, but all his rulings are subject to appeal in accordance with the nature and gravity of the issues involved in the disagreement. None of these angelic groups exercise direct or arbitrary control over the domains of their assignment. They cannot fully control the affairs of their respective realms of action, but they can and do so manipulate planetary conditions and so associate circumstances as favorably to influence the spheres of human activity to which they are attached. The Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision utilize many agencies for the prosecution of their missions. They function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. While unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human minds, they often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared within a human intellect. But aside from these many means of positive action, the Master Seraphim ensure planetary progress against vital jeopardy through the mobilization, training, and maintenance of the Reserve Corps of Destiny. The chief function of these reservists is to ensure against breakdown of evolutionary progress. They are the provisions which the celestial forces have made against surprise. They are the guarantees against disaster.
One of the things that really strikes me about the this recital are the different numbers that have been changed on these various 12 groups of 12. And it appears to me that the more that these groups have turned over are represent the areas of most significant challenge. And I wonder if they get burned out.
Crystal, and I think I would go about it in a slightly different way than you have. I think that the reasons to turn over personnel working on a problem mostly have to do with the progression of the problem, the need for new ideas, the need for new approaches. The group that has been changed most is number 10, the Angels of Industry. The current group serving was the seventh group. What that says to me is that the conditions of industry, the conditions of economic life, have changed repeatedly and dramatically since Pentecost. Whereas by comparison, the Angels of the Races are the first group since Pentecost. They're dealing with the same issues that they were dealing with 2,000 years ago. There isn't a need for new initiatives or new views because the same problems are still there.
Because they still exist.
Yes. In other words, I think that the rotations occur because of changes that require new initiatives and new measures by the respective seraphic corps.
Because I noticed that the Angels of Health and the Home Seraphim also have changed a lot.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, the home.
Well, and home life has changed quite a bit, and we're currently in the throes of an experiment all over the planet with allowing same-sex marriages, and that certainly has huge implications for the structure of the family. You can imagine that they're looking at that very, very carefully and looking at how best to unfold that kind of a development on the planet. But it's occurring planet wide at this point, at least in the first world.
Andre, although I would certainly not undercut the idea that this is a significant innovation, I think the greatest changes in the area of home life and indeed in the area of society as a whole have pertained to the changing roles of women in society.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. that it is the roles of women in being able to participate actively that generate a need for substantial adjustment in regard to the family. And no
mm-hmm.
one is saying, no one is saying that women should be constrained to the home. Not at all. The point is that the change in the roles of women that are possible, conceivable, and worth encouraging has created a situation in which there need to be major adjustments at home as well.
Sure. I'm just remarking on that as one of the most recent developments and speaking at it, of it fairly neutrally and saying it's going to be very, very interesting what kind of experiment results from this, since in the Revelation they definitely talk about the superior possibilities, you know, with the diverse natures of a man and a woman being together, and yet, you know, we also have the situation in our society where the home has broken down quite a bit. There, the number of single parent families is huge, with tremendous implications. There's so many things affecting the home, not just in Western culture, but in cultures all over the earth, that I can only imagine what this group of home seraphim is having to deal with.
Well, the home life is susceptible to the vicissitudes of society, perhaps more than any other institution, because of the child-rearing potential. As I see it in a still larger perspective, the vicissitudes between modernity and tradition for the last at least 300 years, certainly since the 18th century and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but probably influenced prior to that, but certainly since then, my guess is it's accelerated from the so-called extended family to the nuclear family. It's enormous, involves a great deal of breakdown and stress and reconstruction, and more breakdown and stress and more reconstruction. And I could appreciate Neil's point about requiring some new staff, new viewpoints to address that. The home life is not the only institution vulnerable to the tremendous forces between modernity and tradition that as they contend. In the 20th century, they accelerated enormously. And on top of that, the world wars. The history has not yet been written of the effects of the world wars on civilization, on mothers and grandmothers, and on wives and daughters and sisters, let alone husbands and fathers and brothers. The effects are enormous. They're vast and deep.
And let me just break in on you briefly, Charles. I want to just station identify and say that you're about to leave the Cosmic Citizen. We're going to go into archive time now, but thank you, everyone, for listening. As you lose us now, we'll continue the discussion on for a few more minutes, and you can listen on the archive. Thanks.
To change the subject also...